The Passover Seder, an interesting statistic is that 92% of American Jews sit down at a Seder on Passover, which is unusual in that that many do not fast on Yom Kippur and that many do not light Hanukkah candles. So for whatever it is the holiday that is most widely observed in the American Jewish community. That doesn't mean everybody has a Seder like I have. Lots of people just sit down at a table, say it's Passover, they might have a bagel on the table, but they're calling it a Seder, so hence it's a Seder. It's the time that we remember. We cried out to God when we were slaves. God heard our cry and God took us out of Egypt. Right? So that's a pretty big story to remember. If you think like on a personal level, if anything ever bad, if you were ever in a lousy situation or you were stuck and somebody saved you, think of how significant that moment was to you, whoever it was that saved you. And we don't all have that experience of having been saved, but lots of people have a sense of being stuck, I remember once when I fell off my bike when I was a kid and some person helped me up. I mean, I remember that moment vividly, right? So on an individual level, you could imagine that. So for the Jewish people, we were slaves. And the book of Exodus says, God heard us cry out and God took us out of Egypt. So that's a big story for us. Plus, it's the birth of us as a people. The book of Genesis is all about this family clan, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, their wives. It's not about the Jewish people. It's in the book of Exodus that we're first known as the children of Israel. And I liken that to, for Americans, it's a big deal when we talk about the Boston Tea Party and our birth as a nation. July 4th is a significant day for us. So it's on all those different levels that Passover is important. The book of Exodus says that God told the Israelites to prepare, that they were going to flee, and they were going to flee, and that's why their bread didn't rise, right? I mean, that's why we eat matzah, because the bread didn't have a chance to leaven, and they fled from the Egyptians. And before they did, I mean, this is one of these pivotal moments in the story, God says that the Israelites should slay a lamb and put the blood of the lamb on the doorpost. So why were they supposed to slay a lamb? Most people aren't really so sure, but if you know a little bit about Egyptian culture, you know that at the time, the lamb was symbolic of a deity. So being in Egypt as a slave people, having the courage to slay a lamb and put that blood on your doorpost was a sign. And the text says it's a sign for me. Well, for me, meaning God. A close reading of the text, God doesn't need a sign. God's God. God knows where the Israelites are, right? God didn't really need us to put the blood on the doorpost to know where the Israelites were. But clearly God wanted the Israelites to stand up and be counted and say, I'm prepared to leave here. And he asked them to do something really rather bold by slaying the lamb. They did that, and then, you know, they left Egypt. They fled. And Jewish tradition assumes that lots of Israelites did not flee Egypt, that lots of them stayed in Egypt because they were afraid, because they didn't know what it was, because that was an enormous request that God put upon the people. A premise of the Seder, it's really a significant line that it is often and traditionally it's sung at the Seder, and it's what the whole evening is about. It comes from the Mishnah, and it says, in every generation, a person should see him or herself as if he or she were slaves in Egypt. Behold, dor vador chayav adam lirot et atzmo ki'ilu hu haya b'mitzrayim. And the idea is that the Seder is about, you start out as a slave, and at the end of the night, you are free. And it begins, I mean, one of the opening lines is, you know, last year we were slaves, this year we are free. And the premise is that everyone sitting around the table should do a drama for the evening. And the drama is to go back and pretend. And that is an important part of Jewish theology of what the Seder is about. Is that it's not about what happened to them. It's not social studies. It's about what happened to us. We were there. And that's what makes it different than, say, when I talk about the American Revolution. The American Revolution is about what happened to them. I wasn't there. I don't pretend to have been there in 1776 or anything related to it. But when we're talking about the Exodus, I was there. And the preparing for the Seder gives me just a little taste of that hard work so that by the time I get to the table, I'm good and fatigued. And I say that a little bit in jest and a little bit seriously, which is I do think that part of the preparations physically, the fatigue is a part of the experience. It is a meal filled with rituals. I mean, the entire Every aspect of it is filled with ritual, from the food that you eat to how you eat it to how you sit. There's a book, literally. The word Seder means order. There's a whole order of things that you're supposed to do. And there's a book called the Haggadah that you read through. What's the purpose of it? The word Haggadah means telling. It's the telling of the story of when we were slaves and we cried out and God heard us cry and God took us out of Egypt. The purpose is to be engaging and to bring who's ever sitting around the table into the conversation. And the sages gave us these tools on how to do that. And the challenge to the person leading to the Seder is to use those tools effectively with the participants that they have. You taste freedom, you sing about it, you read about it, you talk about it. It's a premise, by the way, the Seder, last year in our Seder when Adam was with us, we talked about the four children, right? And part of the Seder talks about the wise child, the wicked one, the simple, the one who doesn't know to ask, meaning the purpose is to make this story accessible to everyone who's at the table in any way that you can, because they got to get it, because it's our most important story. It's our defining story of how we were born as a people. And every effort is made to create educational experiences to meet the different learners. And one way that you do that is through different experiences. And that's why, you know, a good Seder includes great food, it includes great singing, it includes great discussion. Sometimes it includes great games. There are people, I'm not one of them, but there are people now who literally physically have everybody come dressed as a slave, and they, you know, they're in their basement and they're acting it out. I'm sort of a little more traditional than that, so you have to sit around my dining room table, but the idea is still the same. At my house, you figure we're going to start around 7 and we'll be done by around midnight to 12:15. But by no means do I want you to think that everybody does that, right? Lots of people, my sister will be done by 10 o'clock. She's got young girls and she wants them in bed. Or the flip is, more traditional Jews, I've been at Seders that have been going on until 2 or 3 in the morning. I just don't know how to do that, clean up, and then be in synagogue the next morning. So midnight, 12:30 feels like a good, reasonable place. And a lot of it is really about the discussion of what happened and understanding not just what happened, but how we've understood what's happened and how we've told the story over the years. I'm going to guess that in Jesus' time, it probably took quite a while, because what else did people do? They sat and they ate and they told the story, because it was a more religious society. Not that it was a more religious society. There were fewer distractions. But it's not that it was, I know it wasn't as formalized, but the meal probably went on for quite some time just because they were sitting and talking. And I don't know that they were singing exactly the things that we sing today. In fact, some of them I'm sure were not, but others I'm sure they did sing. The Seder was a secondary experience in Jesus' lifetime. The big deal was the trek to Jerusalem and going to the temple. Being at the Seder was eating the food that was sacrificed, and I imagine it's the food that was sacrificed. And the people who were having a Seder were not at the temple. And the temple was the place of action. The temple was the place to be. First century Jewish theology says God was in the temple. Now we have this notion of you can pray anywhere. You can pray in your house. You can pray in the woods. You can pray at the synagogue. God hears you, whether you're at the Church of the Resurrection or whether you're a congregation, Beth Shalom. God's everywhere. That's modern Jewish theology. First century theology, the temple was the place where God dwelled. Going to the temple meant going to have access to God. Anyone who was celebrating the Passover not in the temple, they were celebrating it because it was such a significant event, but they were definitely not in the inner circle. And if I know Jesus' teachings right now, I shouldn't be the one saying this to the congregation, but if I'm understanding Jesus' teachings right, part of his frustration with first century Judaism is that who got to the temple were the elite of society, the feeble or the infirm or the poor. You know, to take a trek down from the Galilee to get to the temple, only certain people in society could do that. It's important to understand that that Jesus' disciples were not at the heart of the action that night. And that's an important piece to sort of understand what they were doing. The core of what the community was observing was in the temple. So, and they were not at a Seder like the Seder that I'm going to have in the middle of the month. It wasn't nearly as, there wasn't a Haggadah, right? First of all, there were books, but there wasn't a Haggadah. They didn't have a set formal Seder in the way that we have today. They ate lamb, they had maror, a bitter herb, and they ate matzah, because that's what it says in the book of Exodus. All the other rituals that are on my table today are later developments. The book of Exodus commands us that you should eat matzah, you should eat the bitter herb, and you should eat the lamb, okay? When we eat the matzah, actually the blessing that we say, praise are you, Lord our God, rule of the universe, who brings forth bread from the earth, that's actually the same blessing we say if I were eating a bagel or a pita. So there's another blessing that acknowledges the commandment to eat the matzah. So I assume that Jesus said, in Hebrew, Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam Asher Kitchenu Mitzvotav V'Tzivanu Al Achilat Matzah. Praise are you, Lord our God, rule of the universe, who has commanded us to eat this matzah. And then he also said a bracha, I'm sure, when he ate the bitter herb, Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam Asher Kitchenu Mitzvotav V'Tzivanu Al Achilat Maror. Praise are you, Lord our God, ruler of the universe, who has commanded us to eat this bitter herb. Those pieces, there's no doubt that he said a blessing and understood that he was fulfilling a commandment to eat those things. The other part of the meal that I'm sure that Jesus had, that was in place in Jesus' time, was these four cups of wine that were a part of the Seder. And the four cups of wine remind us of the four promises that God made to the Israelites that God would redeem us. It's from a verse in Exodus where in four instances a different verb is used, but in each instance it's God will take us out, God will bring us into the land, God will redeem us. Each of those verbs we understood as the promise that God made to us to make sure that we wouldn't be enslaved. The sages wanting to focus on that verse, but again, in a way that was experiential, right? You ask any kid, they'll tell you there are four cups of wine at a Seder. They may not know the verse from Exodus, but they know the idea. So there was a magic in the way the verses were put to life. That's where we have the four cups of wine from. And they're actually long blessings that Jesus would have probably said over the wine. The short one would be, Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam Borei Pri HaGafen, and praised are you, Lord our God, ruler of the universe, who creates the fruit on the vine. But it went along with a longer text which acknowledged that God was redeeming us from Egypt and that was the promise God made to us. It is celebratory now. I mean, there's no question about it now. It is the Yiddish word is freilach, an upbeat, you know, spring is here, you see the tulips coming, it's all about the green after this long winter. I would think that the same would be true then, because it's all about remembering the story of our birth. And it has a good ending for us. We're out. We're in our own land. So those were all the positive things. And so my sense is that it would be quite celebratory. Now, having said that, first century, the times were rough in Judea at the time. So the celebration is clearly going to be tempered by the fear of the Romans and the uncertainty of the times. I mean, they were very uncertain times politically. And so any celebration would have to be tempered by that. Just like if September 11th had happened on April 11th or March 11th, my Seder would not have had that same celebratory feel that it had 6 months later. And the times were really rough, and I think sometimes we tend to minimize how difficult it was to be Jewish and living in Judea in the year 20, 30, 35. I mean, it was a very difficult time. I think that the Seder is so wide. First of all, I think it we continue to do it because, you know, we're told in the book of Exodus that you will mark this, and in Deuteronomy again, and you'll mark it in the spring. So part of the reason we do it is simply because it says so. But the reason that it's done so zealously is, I will argue, in part because it's a family experience, in part because I think it resonated for people throughout the ages to think about freedom. It's this universal idea that people could really completely relate to. I also think that it connects very much to you know, for a good part of our 2,000-year history that is since Jesus' time until now, We've been, sadly, a downtrodden people. I mean, the Jewish history in Europe was not, you know, it was a difficult time. And I think telling the story of redemption and telling the story of how God took us out of our misery was a story that resonated with people. And the story of hope is a story that people would return to. Plus, it's such a rich ritual. One of the things that people love about it, I mean, my sense is that they love the ritual because ritual really speaks to them. And so it is repeated yearly because we're commanded to, but it is done with such passion and joy, I think, because it spoke to people's emotional needs, and it allowed for a family gathering in a way that's different, say, than Rosh Hashanah, where that all the action takes place in the synagogue. I think that's a big piece of it. So for people like me, it's about hope and God and redemption. But for folks who never go to synagogue, who aren't even synagogue members, who have that bagel on their plate, it's a story about how the downtrodden of society can have hope. And an ethical principle of trying to help those who are less fortunate than you is one that speaks to people. So of those 92%, lots of people probably don't talk about God. But what they talk about is, we were slaves in Egypt. We know what it was like to be a slave. Our job is to make sure that the people enslaved today are being helped. That totally speaks to American Jews. I mean, that even so, if they're uncomfortable talking about God, they're not uncomfortable talking about social action. So in my ideal, the way in which the Seder shapes you is the way it shaped me, right? When I sit down at the Seder, I think of my grandparents, I think of my father, my mother, and my siblings, and my cousins, and I think of coming together and having these kind of conversations, these conversations about what was important, that it's about creating these Jewish memories. And I think, I mean, part of what happens is that it's not that it's one Seder, but it's one Seder and another and another and another, and it's a lifetime of Seders. And the lifetime, I think, has this effect of creating Jewish memories. And as opposed to the memories of the Sabbath, which are very much, some are in the home, but a lot of them are in the synagogue, the entire Passover experience, or the large part of it, is a home experience. It's not a community; it's a familial experience. And so that's how I think that's where I think it's really important. And the other piece is, it allows for conversations that, in the course of a busy life, you don't have. I mean, as a rabbi with three children, I confess I do not talk with my daughter about the Israelites or when we were given the Torah or when we were enslaved on a regular basis. I'm too busy getting people to dance or taekwondo or where they're supposed to be or doing my own writing or helping them with their homework. We don't sit down and have these great theological conversations on a regular basis. So again, last year Adam witnessed this really lovely conversation that we had with my daughter. Sadly, they're not an every night thing, but in a sense, I think that just shows that we're human, and this gives the structure and the opportunity for me to know we will have that conversation. It will be had, and it will be engaged in. The people who are going to sit at my Seder table all have a common desire, and the desire is to talk about the Exodus, and to talk about the fact that we cried out, God heard our cry, and God took us out of Egypt, and how we've told that story. And I think you have then, the people sitting around the table have this connectedness. Like, by the way, when I teach a class for 2 years, if the same people come every week, and they're sitting for an hour each week studying with me, those folks connect. And the reason they connect is because they have the same, I mean, they're all looking for answers from our sacred text. And so there is a certain kind of connectedness. And, you know, good food and a little wine helps in creating that kind of fellowship.